Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. I am Dr. Kaveh Hoda. I will be your host on this little medical podcast where we look at the intersections of health, science, popular culture, and politics. I'm still working out the tagline for the show, like 4 years in. I haven't figured out like a good tagline yet, but if you guys have one, let me know. Today, we're talking about violence against doctors and healthcare workers in general. Joining me to do that, we have some very special guests. First of all, returning champion, one of my favorite people on planet Earth. And actually, I'm gonna go out on a limb and say the entire solar system. Ryan Marino, Dr. Ryan Marino. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. How's it going?
God, I miss you, man. I really do. I really miss you. Like, I go like five shows without you, and that's like my max. That's where I max out. I can do like five episodes without you and then I'm done.
It feels weird to not be here.
You should be here, man. You should be here. I'm glad you're here. This is a good topic. It's not like the most fun topic, but I'm glad you're here to help me through it. But we have two guests that we're going to talk to today. And I'm very excited to have both of them on. Let's start with MD, PhD, Dr. Allison Huckenpaller. How are you, Dr. Huckenpaller?
You know, glad to be here talking with you guys.
Can we call you Allison?
Of course.
And you are a psychiatry resident, is this correct?
Yep, at Barnes Jewish in St. Louis.
How are you liking psychiatry so far? How's it going for you?
You know, it's going great. Made the right choice. I'm pretty happy.
Was it psychiatry or something else?
I actually applied to three different specialties in the match.
Which ones?
Psychiatry, neurology, and internal medicine. So
okay, that tracks. You're like neurology, psychiatry, they're pretty similar. I mean, the vibe is there. Internal medicine, that was your safety one. I get it. I know. I'm an internal medicine doctor. I get it. I know. Also joining us, we have Yusuf Fauzi, a medical student at Stanford. Yusuf, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I went to Berkeley, so I am going to have to give you shit the whole time, right?
Well, I can take it.
Good, good, good. How is medical school going?
It is certainly going and not stopping, but on rotations and doing surgery. So working those long hours, but it's been great so far.
Are you just holding retractors at this point, or are you actually getting to like do stuff?
Well, I'm doing plastics in hand, so there's a lot of looking at small fields, but there's a fair amount of doing too.
What's the longest surgery you've had to watch at this point?
Probably 6 hours, so it wasn't terrible.
That's pretty rough, man. Wait, were you there just standing the whole time?
I was suctioning. I was holding some tissue. I was doing the things.
Did you get a pee break? Or were you there the whole time?
I was there. I was there for it. But I'm staying positive because I'm on Gen Surge next month. So I think it's only going to get longer.
Yes, good. I get you. I hope you really get to experience like a 12-hour case and just really feel it. Good for you. What are you going to do? What are you going to go into?
Probably emergency medicine.
All right. Yeah. Well, Ryan, what? How do you feel about that, Ryan? What do you say to that?
That's the best specialty, hands down.
I feel like there's a bias here. Ryan, what was the longest when you were in medical school or residency? When you're doing residency, I think you probably do surgery, right? Do they ever have you go in as an emergency medicine? You do surgery rotations, right?
Yeah, I think in my residency, I was the last person to do general surgery. And I was just the surgery consult for the entire hospital. It was really fun. Treated a lot of constipation.
Do you remember like one of those really long surgeries? What was the longest you had to stay in for?
I think when I was in med school, one of them was like almost 12 hours. It was the entire day.
That's intense, man. I mean, listeners who don't know, why this is really a challenge is because as a medical student, you usually don't get to do much. You're usually just standing there for hours pretending to be super excited about something you're not getting to do, you know, like you're like watching this happen. You're kind of just like, you're ready to go because they might ask you a question at any point and you have to be like ready to go. You can't be daydreaming about what you're going to eat for dinner. You know, you kind of have to be in the moment. It's pretty intense. I'm so glad I'm not doing it anymore. But on to an equally painful conversation. We're going to talk about violence against doctors. And the reason we're doing this, well, I mean, because it keeps happening. But, you know, recently in the news, there was the story you guys, I'm sure, all know about. There was an orthopedic surgeon in Memphis by the name of Dr. Benjamin Mock. I think I'm saying that correctly. He was shot to death by his patient. You know, he was in the news cycle for about a day or two, kind of went away. All the stories referred to him as a top doctor, quote unquote, or a well-esteemed doctor. Like, that makes any difference. Like, it's any better if he was like a bad doctor. But this is tragic and horrific story. He's a father of two. And the basic elements of it, we still don't entirely know why it happened, but the person who is the alleged murderer is Larry Pickens. He'd been waiting for a couple hours before, you know, executing the 43-year-old doctor inside of his exam room. It was his only murder was the doctor, which the articles of the day were all like, great, it's all okay. It was just one guy. It wasn't a mass shooting, which for like American standards is like awesome, I guess. The police didn't disclose a possible motive, but the Tennessee Senate Minority Leader Ramesh Akbari said that the shooter had threatened a clinic employee over the course of the prior week. And per the New York Post, he had been institutionalized approximately 10 times for his mental health. I mean, this is the New York Post, so take it for what it is. And interestingly enough, the story says that this Pickens, the guy who was the alleged murderer, his stepfather was actually someone he had attacked with a knife before. And Dr. Mock actually had helped take care of the stepfather that he had attacked. I don't know if there's any involvement there or if the Dr. Mock was treating Mr. Pickens directly. I don't know. But it brings to light the story. I want to talk about it while it's still kind of in people's memories. And I want to start with some basic facts, if we have them. And we'll start with the very basics. How common is violence against medical professionals? Allison, why don't we start with you?
So unfortunately, violence against healthcare workers is shockingly common. Fortunately, very few of these attacks are fatal. So Bureau of Labor Statistics is the big tracking organization in the US. They collate data from hospitals about both fatal and non-fatal attacks on healthcare workers. And in 2020, there were only 64, again, only 64 fatal attacks against healthcare workers, compared to about 500,000 non-fatal attacks against healthcare workers. So fortunately, when you look at the big picture, very few of these attacks are fatal. But when they are, they tend to make the news and tend to be like very shocking. They kind of rattle us to our core.
You know, I should also mention here that the reason you both are on, other than you're both astounding young professionals in your field, and Ryan and I like to feel old and have younger people on the show, is that you both have written about this. And there's not a lot of people writing about this. I feel like the only people writing about it are people kind of younger and in the start of their careers. Why do you guys think that is? Why is this a subject that you guys started paying attention to and following the research on?
Well, unfortunately, I got involved with this following the last big publicized shooting of a doctor, Dr. Phillips in Tulsa. And that prompted one of the journal editors to reach out and ask us, you know, with the same questions, how common is this? Like, can we do anything to prevent this? And it's kind of disappointing that, you know, a year later, it kind of feels like we're still at the same spot. But these are big systemic issues and, you know, they're going to be slow to change. But it is very disheartening as a doctor to be like, wow, okay, like, we're still here.
Yeah, no one else is talking about it either. Yusuf, what about yourself?
Yeah, so I actually fell into the workplace violence space during my gap years. I was working over at Kaiser, kind of as their safety operations leader. And a big part of my portfolio was how do we prevent workplace violence and how do we deal kind of with the growing epidemic of violence in the workplace. So I focused a lot on threat management, building systems and infrastructures to respond to workplace violence. And this was at the height of the pandemic. So it was quite interesting. And it's just become a topic that's near and dear to me, and I've carried it through med school. And I don't see it going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
Ryan, you work in the emergency room, which is, you know, I think most people would imagine is one of the most unsafe places for doctors to be. I mean, I'll have our two guests weigh in on that. But is this something that you guys talk about? Is this something you guys sort of, that's on your minds in the emergency room?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is something that happens all the time, and probably more often than gets reported or that people take seriously even. But it's definitely a challenge. I mean, it makes the work hard. It makes it hard to treat patients. And I don't know that there's necessarily like always a lot of good answers or great discussions that even come from it.
But it's something that weighs on you, I'm sure. I'm sure it has a part of that. So talking a little bit more about these attacks, we talked about the non-fatal ones. What is the mechanism of most of these attacks? Are they gun? Are they knife? Are they this physical violence? What? Tell us a little bit about that.
So I'm not sure there's great evidence from what I've seen about that. The best data bank is the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And unfortunately, that is still very high level. Kind of the suggestion from the data that I've gotten is that most of these are, again, just physical attacks with like fists or their body, not usually using a weapon.
I'd agree. You know, taking it a step back, I think, you know, zooming out from the non-fatal side, verbal threats and, you know, what they categorize as like a verbal acts of violence is by far more common than physical across most countries from what I've seen, including in the US. And then like Allison mentioned, when you look at the physical acts of violence, a lot of it is hands, fists. You see it in patients that are kind of elderly, that have dementia, folks that are in the ED that aren't fully aware of what's going on, that are altered. And it kind of escalates from there, from the scratching and fists to, you know, throwing things like oxygen tanks or mayo trays or whatever they can get their hands on. But it's kind of like a sliding scale, I would say.
Is there any sense of there being an increase in acts of violence against healthcare workers since COVID? I mean, it certainly feels like it, but I mean, is there any evidence that that's actually happening?
Yes. So from what I've found, there's been a pretty substantial increase in violence against healthcare workers since COVID. And I think one of the things that's been noticeable for me is that it's extended outside of the hospital as well, to the point where there are now, you know, verbal, sometimes physical attacks against healthcare workers and sometimes digital attacks, you know, doxing, et cetera, against healthcare workers like in a non-professional space.
Yusuf, same with you?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen data out there to support the fact that there's an increase in workplace violence. I think part of that has to do with COVID, and I think part of it has to do with the increase in reporting now that this topic is getting more visibility. I think some hospital systems are starting to adjust and trying to build infrastructure for reporting, but I think we've got ways to go on that front.
Ryan, you notice it too, right? Just like since COVID, that thin veil of civility that people have learned to wear has just basically fallen. Like, I feel like even outside of the hospital, but particularly in the hospital with patients and even sometimes with colleagues, I feel like things are much more combative than they've ever been in the past. Is that your impression as well?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like just that not even the lack of kind of civility, but harassment, like very serious targeted kind of things. Not necessarily violence, I guess, but definitely people doing malicious things and trying to hurt healthcare workers in some way or another.
You mean like having a whole segment on the Tucker Carlson show about, like, say, a doctor that they don't like and sending all their nasty, nasty little minions against them, something like that?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't know anything about that.
I feel like people everywhere are just a little bit worse. I was out where I was in Sausalito, beautiful little neighborhood in north of San Francisco, walking with my wife and pushing a baby in a stroller. And these people were jogging behind us and they started yelling at us. We're on a sidewalk. They're like, get out of the way. We're trying to run here. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And I look back and this guy was like, they were like yelling at us. We moved out of the way. And they're like, fuck, get out of the way. I'm like, we're just walking on the sidewalk. I mean, like, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like people are looking for a fight no matter what now. I feel like it's happening. It's definitely come through in emails. Like, I think when sometimes when doctors are looking through their emails from patients now, I feel there's some degree of PTSD we're all getting from that. I think we're all a little bit more reluctant to look at our inboxes and take care of them the way we should, because the likelihood of getting a nasty email in there from somebody is really high. And I've heard doctors talk about this a lot. Like, people forget that there is a human person on the other end of that. Whether or not there's a power dynamic, there's totally one with between doctor and patients, and that's true. I get it. But the doctors are still humans. So I definitely think it's been getting worse overall. So I guess I'm not surprised if I hear that acts of violence against healthcare workers have gone up. You know, in reason 4,333, why the internet's a terrible place, I posted something recently about this attack in Memphis and the murder of this doctor. And most of the comments on it were supportive or, God, that's awful and tragic. But there was a significant number of people who responded with something like, nah, well, the doctor probably didn't take care of their pain the way they should have. Or, you know what, doctors should be listening to patients. And I'm just like, God, I just didn't think that people would need to both sides this particular topic, but they certainly did. So one of the things that came up a lot, actually, in that post when I posted it, was people talking about how this occurs in all countries. We're not special. It has nothing to do with America's love of guns and our gun violence. But is that true from your perspective, Allison and Yusuf? Have you guys noticed, is there any difference between the numbers of attacks on healthcare professionals here in this country versus other countries?
So the data is a little bit messy in terms of prevalence of workplace violence in different countries. I would say that there is literature that supports the concept of higher acts of workplace violence in certain countries, especially in Asia, but it does not really distinguish verbal acts of violence versus non-fatal physical acts of violence versus fatal acts of violence, by guns and things of the sort. But on the other hand, there is data that shows lower acts of workplace violence in certain countries, like in Europe. So it's hard to tell. And part of that is just an issue with data collection across the globe.
Well, I want to talk more about like the gun aspect, because I feel like that can't be a similar problem anywhere else. And the amount of guns that, I mean, I have experienced anecdotally in my own work just seems disturbing. treating people who have been shot, you always have to risk someone coming into the hospital. There are retaliation shootings. Just a couple of weeks ago, a nearby hospital, a group of people tried coming in with assault rifles. I mean, I've been doing like an abdominal exam on a patient and felt a gun in their waistband. Those kind of things, just, I don't think that that's happening anywhere else. That has to be an American issue.
It feels pretty American. Does that sound about right to you guys?
I would generally agree with that, but I think, you know, like Yusuf said, the data just isn't really fleshed out in very complete ways. But yes, I would say, like, just based on the higher levels of gun violence in America in general, that, and anecdotal experience as well, I would say yes.
Ryan, what do you do when you are doing an exam on a patient and they have a gun on them? What do you do in those situations?
I mean, I leave the room. There's no reason for me to be a part of that. If someone brings a gun in, I mean, they don't have an emergency, a life-threatening emergency that needs to be addressed, then they can be discharged.
Do you feel like there is enough security? Like, do you feel like, what would make you feel safe?
Well, I think the problem is not everywhere has completely secure, like, exits and entrances. I mean, some of the hospitals I've worked at have had very few exits and entrances. Some of them have a ton and they're just wide open. So, I mean, most emergency departments now have metal detectors to get in. But if someone comes in by ambulance, goes in through like the back door, or enters the hospital through another way, there's a lot of ways to get past that. And I think even, I mean, metal detectors and whatever security measures aren't always perfect. But yeah, it seems, and people are trying to bring guns in sometimes, especially for like retaliation things. That is concerning. And in this doctor who was in his clinic, I don't know what you do, screen everybody in your, if you have a small clinic, people sitting in the waiting room, someone has a hidden firearm on them, I don't know how you can address that. Definitely seems like a problem more with the guns than with adding more security to every healthcare interaction.
Yeah. I mean, how much can we do? No one wants to go to their doctor and have to get patted down. You know, I don't know what they're expecting from this. Do you guys, in your, you're looking at the data on this, do you feel like there are, and we talked about a little bit before with the emergency room, but do you feel like there are specialties that are more at risk? I'm assuming the ER is one, but I'm assuming there's more than that too.
Absolutely. So the most affected specialties are the emergency room, psychiatry, and geriatrics. And there's pretty strong data that supports that. These are likely because these are environments in which you have a high percentage of patients that are either intoxicated, psychotic, delirious, or have dementia. And all four of those things are risk factors for violence. So it makes sense that you have a population that's enriched for these traits, which puts you at increased risk for violence. So it makes a lot of sense why those three would be most affected.
Is it my imagination, or I feel like pain medicine doctors are at high risk for this? I feel like people who don't feel like their pain is being controlled are angry in a way that could lead to a violence, like an act of violence. Is that my imagination?
Absolutely not. Anecdotally, I will say that that's a trend I've also experienced in terms of like what the data suggests is one of the what's called like flash points for violence is when patients feel like their pain is not being adequately treated. And another one is the following of rules rigidly without kind of a consideration for the patient. And typically when you have a patient in the hospital that's saying, you know, I'm in pain, I need more opioids, I need more this, that tends to be a situation where you've set up a situation where one, they feel as though their needs are not being responded to. Two, you've set up this area where the doctor is more likely to kind of rigidly comply to a set of rules because there are, you know, people watching how many opioids are prescribed in this, especially in like pain management clinics, outpatient pain management clinics, where, you know, following the opioid crisis, there's been a lot of appropriate watchfulness about what's being prescribed. So it really sets up almost a powder keg where you have like just a confluence of situations that just are pretty ripe for violence.
It seems like recently in the past few years, there's been at least a handful of cases though were specifically related to a feeling of untreated pain where the physician or prescriber was murdered. And that is where I've seen these disturbing responses where it's like justifying the, well, if someone's in pain, they got to do what they got to do. And not to say that people should be left in pain, but I mean, it's murder. That's kind of an extreme. Yeah. I thought that was something we could all agree on.
Well, yeah. Dr. Phillips, the case of the shooting in Tulsa, which was actually kind of inspired my research in this, was murdered because of a patient who, following his back surgery, felt his pain wasn't being adequately controlled and blamed the surgeon for this. So, you know, there's like high level data, but there's also these very powerful anecdotes of that as well. Yeah.
I think one thing that also ties into the pain clinic aspect is a lot of folks that are being seen in outpatient pain clinics long-term, I know from the literature, chronic pain patients have higher rates of psychiatric diagnoses like PTSD, depression, substance abuse, which are all things that have been shown to increase kind of the rates of workplace violence. So it's kind of this, you know, perfect storm of sorts in terms of this very vulnerable, you know, group.
I have to say, I was a little surprised when you mentioned, Allison, that geriatrics was one of the top three. Explain that to me, why geriatrics would be involved.
So when you think about geriatrics, like, you know, you're an internal medicine doc, you see this all the time when you're looking at like delirium or dementia, huge risk factors for violence. You think about people get agitated because they're not sure where they are. You know, that strikes a lot of fear into like patients. And when you think about healthcare workers, you know, we're not talking about just the hospital. We're also talking about nursing homes or like home health aides. So there's, you know, the elderly interact quite a bit more with the healthcare system, and they tend to be, you know, more likely to have these traits of, you know, delirium or dementia, which put them at greater risk for violence. So it's, you know, it's funny when we think about, we don't think about like, you know, grandma like attacking the doctor with her handbag. You know, I think part of the reason that we've had such a hard time with finding nurses and staff to work in, you know, nursing facilities is because there's such a high rate of violence.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Are there certain clinician features that are more at risk? Or, for example, are women more likely to be victims of violence in healthcare than men? Or is that my imagination?
So data suggests that women are more likely to be victims of verbal aggression, whereas men are more likely to be victims of actual physical aggression.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I mean, it's just bad news all around. Yeah. But this is also, I think what's a little concerning is that this is a very intersectional problem. Clinicians that are from another country or that have an accent are also at increased risk of like experiencing violence from a patient. And minorities are actually at an increased risk of experiencing violence from patients. So it's really like a very powerful, you know, combination. If you have, you know, if you happen to be, you know, a minority or, you know, someone from a foreign country or someone with an accent, this is, you know, like a real threat.
That is very interesting and disturbing. What's the thought behind that? I mean, is it because there's just I'm assuming some component of racism, but is there something else to it, to that? Is there something like the patients are feeling their communication isn't as good? I mean, obviously racism is the number one feature here, but is there something else I'm missing there?
So speculation here is that there is an element of power dynamics anytime you have an attack on a healthcare worker, which explains why if you are a nurse, you are far more likely to have experienced violence than a doctor. So there's an element of power dynamics anytime you talk about healthcare violence. And, you know, when you think about systemic structures of racism and, you know, nationalism that kind of contribute to this, like it makes sense to me. This is mostly speculation about trying to explain a trend that we do see in the data, but that's my understanding and my speculation on the cause for it.
I can tell you, I mean, I've seen second opinions on patients, and the patients will be upset about the first doctor that saw them, not to the level of violence or anything, but they'll be talking about the doctor that first saw them. And it's not rare to hear someone say something like, I just couldn't understand their accent and it was really bothering me. That will happen sometimes, and it makes them mad. And it's interesting that it's part of this power dynamic you speak about.
Mm-hmm. It seems like violence and those kind of extremist tendencies seem to go hand in hand with a lot of that, like racism, nationalism, other sort of bigotry and hate groups.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that racists aren't very nice people. I don't know. I'm starting to wonder if
they might be problematic.
I don't know if I'd go that far, Ryan. I mean, I want to look at this from all sides, of course. I mean, racists bring a lot of interesting things to this country. Hold on, let me think. What have racists done for us? NASCAR? I don't know. That's not fair. There's probably a lot of non-racist people who like
country NASCAR. Music.
Yeah, but the good country music is like progressive people like Ray Wiley Hubbard and Chris Christopherson. So yeah, no, not that either. No, I'm not sure what they contribute. I don't think they contribute much. Let me ask you guys, you're young people. You're young, right? You're young people. Ryan and I are old. Look at us. We're sad. We're old. Look at Ryan's beard. Look at that. There's one gray in there. Do you see it? It's terrible. And we don't understand what it's like to be young and virile, such as yourselves. Do you guys feel like this thoughts about this sort of stuff will affect people's choices for what kind of specialty they go into? Is this something you guys have considered in that regards?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, I can't speak to that. I'd say I think it's affected a lot of how people are choosing to progress their career. So, you know, following the pandemic and the increases in like incivility and violence that we've been talking about, we're seeing a lot more people that are retiring or people that are choosing to go to like a less potentially fraught setting. In terms of, you know, we said at the beginning of the podcast, I had a hard time choosing specialty to begin with. So I can't really speak to that.
What about you, Yusuf? Did this affect you at all? Is this something that's going to, you're a medical student. You're in the process. She's already chosen. She's going to be a psychiatrist. It's happening. She's locked in. It's happening. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it does weigh on students as we're considering, you know, what we want to do. A big part of your first years of med school, you really haven't seen much. There are so many specialties you've never come across. A lot of folks that came to med school post-COVID didn't shadow at all during college or after because of all the restrictions. And when your first exposure to a specialty is talking to different doctors and residents, and you ask about, you know, what their days are like, and you talk to someone like Ryan, who's like, well, when I do abdominal exams, I find guns in my patient's waistband. Like, that's
not all of the exams, just 30, 40%.
But it's concerning nonetheless. And I think it does turn people away from certain specialties when you see kind of their day-to-day and what they go through. And I think working in like a pain clinic or working in the ED, it takes a certain someone to be okay with that. I think a lot of people just are in a place where you go through so much to be a doctor, you don't want to have to go through that as well.
Yeah. Do you guys feel like this is contributing to burnout? Is there any data on that?
Oh, there's a ton of data on that, that verbal aggression from patients, physical attacks contribute highly towards burnout. There's very strong data on that.
I mean, nothing is more like after like, if you have a long day of doing hard work in the hospital, you leave tired, but for the most part, you leave feeling some part of your soul has been replenished. You feel like you've done something good. You go home and you sleep great that night. If you have one bad interaction with a patient, that can ruin a week for a doctor. And we don't like that. We want to help people. We want to be people. We're people pleasers for the most part. And we want to help. We want people to be happy. We want people to walk away from every interaction feeling like we contributed some way positively in their life. And when that doesn't happen, you know, even if it's just a small verbal aggression, that weighs on a doctor. That's crushing. That's soul crushing. I mean, part of the risk and the reward of being a doctor, the payoff of being a doctor is that feeling of connection with the patient, you know, that emotional connection. You suck the marrow out of those moments. And if you don't get that, and you get the opposite, you get something toxic back. I mean, it's it'll wreck you. It'll wreck you. I'm not surprised, I guess, to hear that.
I mean, yeah, it bums me out or makes me like, is this really worth it when someone treats you terribly, yells at you, says horrible things, and not to like belabor the same point, I feel it burns me out way more the level of violence we have just in general. And I think probably every specialty, you're going to get the people who are not happy with you, people who are just mean, angry people. But day in and day out, I mean, seeing other people be victims of like gun violence, that kind of thing, that is really kind of soul crushing to me.
Yeah. No, you see, you're the front line of that. You and paramedics, you know, that go to the site, but you're seeing the worst of it in the ER. I mean, I don't know. What do you do, man? How do you keep your faith in humanity when you see violence constantly?
I mean, being part of a team that's taking care of it is, I think, the best part. That is what keeps me going. But I hope that I don't ever like lose the ability to feel bad about that kind of thing. That's the day when I really need to get out of it. That would be a big problem. I'm glad you brought up though paramedics. That was one thing I feel like is probably under-recognized, is like EMS and pre-hospital people face violence from patients, seen situations all the time. And it's probably something that I don't think really gets much attention. And especially because they're usually like overworked and underpaid to begin with. Even just on the highway, people will hit paramedics with their cars, not to mention the ones who actually get murdered, which is probably also under-recognized and reported.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a big challenge in general, kind of piggybacking off of that, is the culture surrounding workplace violence and the culture in different departments, divisions, and fields. I've worked in EMS for about 9 years or so now, and the culture there is very different, a little bit similar to the ED, where it's kind of, you know, this is the job, get it done type of situation. And one of the biggest things that, you know, I struggled with and folks struggle with in general, when you look at people holding jobs and preventing workplace violence, is how do you actually change the culture from this is part of my job, this is normal, and flip that on its tail and say, this is not normal, I should not be yelled at. I should not be assaulted. This is not part of my job. And making that change is very, very challenging. And I think we're finally making that shift as providers and clinicians, which is a step in the right direction.
All right, Yusuf, let me ask you at this point, what do we do about this? What can we do about it? You've studied systems here. You've been working with them. What do you recommend doctors individually do and hospitals do?
So that's a loaded question.
I'm loaded, buddy. I got loaded questions. I'm so pow. Speaking of gun violence, finger bullets at you both. Loaded.
I think that it requires solutions and innovation on multiple fronts, and it requires a multi-tiered response. So on one end, I think we have to equip providers and clinicians with the tools to actually deal with the situations. And an online module about de-escalation for an hour is just not going to cut it. So de-escalation training, super important, can be valuable, but you're not going to get that on online training. So equipping providers and clinicians with, you know, what do? Education. How do you respond when someone comes into a department with a gun? Who do you call? What resources exist? I think all that's really important for the clinician. On the flip side, hospital systems have to really commit to making substantial changes on how they deal with workplace violence. So building out systems for reporting so that when providers do report these incidents, something happens. And we know there's a lot of barriers to underreporting. You know, part of that is a perceived lack of change from reporting, lack of support, not enough time to file reports. But when you build out a system effectively where, you know, so-and-so provider has a violent incident, they report it, it's reviewed by a robust threat management team. That provider gets follow-up within a week about what happened, right? You can see actionable change. And it encourages a culture of reporting because you can physically see what is happening. So I think that we have to equip providers with tools, but as hospital systems, you need to build out robust infrastructure to handle reporting workplace violence, building out security measures, you know, doing hazardous assessments of your facility. There's so much there that I could ramble on and on about.
Do you feel like any place is doing this well?
So my background in terms of where I've worked and what I've seen is limited. I think that there are hospital systems that have really good reporting systems and robust threat management teams that actually review these incidents and follow up on every single incident. You know, we put patients on watch lists that have had multiple acts of workplace violence or that have alarming acts of workplace violence, because we do know that a prior incident of violence is a very strong predictor of a future violent incident. So I think places do a good job. I don't think that it is enough, because one hospital doing this successfully is not going to make a dent in the thousands of hospitals that exist. And not to mention this whole other component that we're kind of neglecting, which is outpatient clinics, which what makes this really challenging is they don't fall under Joint Commission licensing. They abide by very different regulations. They don't have to have security. There isn't metal detectors. They don't have to report violent incidents. I mean, they fall into a whole other category, which makes this a lot more tricky.
Ryan, do you hear from other doctors that they're not being listened to? Do you feel like that is a common thing when ER doctors are threatened, that there's no support for them?
So yes, this is something that I definitely hear, and something that I think is not taken seriously enough, or people don't feel they're being listened to about. But I will say that I feel it's gotten better over time, definitely not where it needs to be. This is something that should never happen. Shouldn't be a question about that, but I think people are listening more and taking it more seriously. The problem, it seems like at the end of the day, is in the United States. I mean, we have a gun problem, we have a violence problem. Those are things that should be addressed. You shouldn't have to make an emergency department an impenetrable fortress. But healthcare is a business. It's based a lot on patient satisfaction. I mean, patients are considered customers, that kind of thing. For me to say I want to throw someone out of my emergency department just because they don't have a life-threatening emergency, which is the letter of the law, I'm going to get in trouble for not making them satisfied, not doing a full whatever, that kind of thing. So those are definitely other considerations. I mean, I think there's a lot of real systemic failures at play here that makes it kind of sad, but I have seen it get better. I do want to say that, like, I feel people do listen to this and take it more seriously now, and I hope that'll continue.
Yeah, me too. Allison, do you have any recommendations for individual doctors to consider, or considerations for individual doctors in this setting? I mean, I'm not like expecting you to teach us Krav Maga or some self-defense techniques, but like, what advice do you have for doctors who are in fields where they might be concerned about this sort of thing?
So speaking as a psychiatrist, this is something that I think about a lot. So the biggest thing that has made a difference for me is the realization that if I feel unsafe for any reason, that is enough for me to terminate an interview. And it's hard because, you know, Ryan and Yusef, you've both talked about like this mentality of like, you got to get it done. You got to get the info, you got to get the IV placed. You know, I think medicine in general attracts like very goal-oriented people who go in and say like, this is the goal. And I think taking a step back and saying, if I feel unsafe for any reason, being able to just walk away is powerful. And having an administration team that will allow you to do that, I think is probably one of the most potent things you can do. Otherwise, like bringing the human element back to it can be really powerful. I've had very good experience with patients saying, I don't appreciate how you're speaking to me right now. I want to help you, but I can't when you're yelling at me. So I will come back when you have calmed down. And, you know, that sounds like it's such psychiatry language. It kind of sounds a little bit like you're talking to a child sometimes, but it's been shockingly helpful. I wouldn't have before I became a psychiatrist, I would not have thought that would have worked. But just calling people on their behavior, or, you know, in a little bit less of a flowery way, like, you're being very rude right now, or you're scaring me that you are raising your voice. And being able to like actually put those names, like, people don't like to see themselves as like the scary, aggressive person. So just calling out that behavior and saying, like, this is not acceptable, I will come back. In terms of like actually kind of like preventing it from getting that far, I personally find like when someone is upset about why, like we talked earlier about rigid adherence to rules being a flashpoint for violence. And sometimes they're just rules that don't make sense, but they exist in the hospital setting, and being able to explain some of that of like, I can't do that because X, Y, and Z, or even just saying, you know what, I don't know, let me go ask someone else. And even if you come back and say, you know what, I tried, but I couldn't do that, it shows that you're trying to establish that you're on their team. And that can be sometimes very helpful.
Yeah. I'm glad you say that. I mean, obviously we got to take into account there's always this power dynamic. Mm-hmm. And almost by definition, you know, these people are seeing us because something's not going right for them. And they may or may not have the tools to handle that well, or to deal with that mechanism well. And we have to be mindful and cognizant of that. And we have to find ways to treat them the best we can. But at the same time, I do think it's important that doctors are able to feel safe in their job. I feel like that is a really basic tenet of what we should be expecting in any profession. So I'm glad you say that. Ryan, you were going to say something?
Yeah. I mean, I think those kind of preventive and de-escalating measures are the best advice, hands down. One thing I think people in healthcare are encouraged not to do, though, is to like consider what is an assault. Like, some of this is crimes are committed, and you're encouraged to kind of just go on with your life, go home, take a day off, whatever, ice your wrist. But I think people should report this more. This should be reported. If not, I mean, escalated to appropriate authorities if a assault has been committed or something along those lines. And I think that is one way that we can see this improve over time. I know I've been told not to do that. So I think people should feel empowered to do so.
Yeah. I mean, getting back to the original story of Dr. Mock, if the reports are true that he had been threatening the office or the doctor or someone in the office the week prior, I mean, it'll be really interesting to see what was done about that and what we can learn from that. I mean, these things should be taken seriously, and medical professionals, nurses, secretaries, doctors, everyone in the office should have the right to report those things. I think that's a good thing. All right, let's go on and finish up with some listener questions. Okay, this first question comes from Stephanie McGann Jansen, a friend of the show, at Steph Jansen at Twitter. She wants us to talk about the AMA statement, which she thought was complete nonsense. Did anyone read the AMA's, American Medical Association, statement on the shooting of Dr. Mock, the orthopedic surgeon, and be willing to tell us what they said?
So I read the statement from the AMA. And for those of you who didn't, it's a message from the top cop for doctors on how to protect themselves or how to address workplace violence. And they've got 4 points here. The first being have situational awareness, which I think is really great advice and kind of like a lot of what we've talked about is just be aware and get yourself out of a situation. Some of the other points I think were maybe a little less helpful, bordering on perhaps a bit tone deaf. Point two is have a survival mindset, which is like a really nice soundbite, but kind of like disappointing if you are like a physician that feels like you're in an unsafe situation. Third point is look to policies, and they talk about like what kind of policies does your health system have in place. And we've talked about how right now those still need to be developed. And Yusuf and Ryan both made really excellent points about how both the reporting and the actual systems need to improve. So looking to the policies feels, you know, like not an actionable step or something that can really be done. And the fourth point is consider combat parking, which if you haven't heard about this is backing into a parking space. So that like, if you need to leave quickly, you can just like jet out. It seems like a little bit unrelated to the other 3 points, but I thought that was...
I have to say it's funny, but you know, I do think about these things. In fact, I did a psychiatry rotation when I was in medical school. I did my 2 months in jail. And you learn in that environment, you learn certain things from the inmates. They're very willing to teach. They're a very interesting place to go for a psychiatry rotation to learn about forensic psychiatry. But there are certain things like you walk into a room, you notice all the exits, you notice where they are, you notice points of egress and entry. You never have your back to an entrance or anything like that. There is that mindset, I guess. But like, I mean, I'm not sure combat parking is all that helpful. I'm not sure that having to have this mindset is the right thing for us. I mean, as an American, you walk into a movie theater, you have to think, okay, where are the exits in case someone comes in with a gun, you know, whatever. But like, you know, you would think that we'd have more to offer than that, you know? That's like the last line of defense.
Oh, I think that's the point that Stephanie is that who submitted the question?
Yeah.
I think that's the point that Stephanie is making, is it feels like we have so little to offer yet at this point, because there's so many things that still need to be improved. So it's hard.
And it feels a little bit like resiliency training, like you should be more resilient rather than the system that's burning you out needs to be changed.
My qualm with this is, there's, you know, barely any mention of how systems have to improve. This very much feels like, let's blame the people that are victims and tell them do better. And that's not the solution.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's a question from Dhruv Bhagavan at Dhruv Bhagavan on Twitter. And he's well known on this show for asking multi-part questions. So I'm just going to ask part one of his three-parter. Where do you draw the line between patient needs care despite violent behavior and patient is an unacceptable threat to healthcare worker safety? Brian, you have the most real-world experience with this, I think, probably working in the emergency room. You've talked about it a little bit, but where do you draw that line?
I mean, I think most like life-threatening conditions are pretty easy to identify. But I think one thing that Allison brought up earlier that was important is a lot of this happens with patients who are intoxicated or experiencing acute psychosis or something along those lines. And those are still medical emergencies. That's not someone I can just dump back outside. But if someone is just has a gun with them and or they're threatening to come to my house because I won't do what they want, that's totally different. So it is hard, I guess, but I feel like it's one of those things not to say like I know it when I see it. But in a lot of cases, it's going to be someone who has an emergency or has some sort of medical condition that does need treatment and needs help for it.
Yusuf, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, from an operational perspective, you know, we talked a little bit earlier, and I wanted to mention this, but there's this concept of early identification, right? So as soon as something is starting to escalate or something seems to be unsafe, I think providers are less likely to ask for help immediately. And part of that's a safety culture, infrastructure issue, and I won't get into that. But the more we kind of train ourselves and have the ability to, you know, call for support, call for security, get PD involved, whatever that is, before situations escalate to an unacceptable threat, I think that's a very worthwhile pursuit. Because oftentimes folks don't come in at 100. Sometimes they do, right? But oftentimes it's some sort of gradual escalation.
One thing that I think is really hard to tease out, though, is say you are responding to like a shooting event and there are people bleeding out there, but is the scene safe? I mean, how do you draw the line? Is that an emergency worth risking your own life to go into? So that it makes it really hard to answer that question.
I'll tell you on the EMS front, like pre-hospital, even if there's a fight, EMS will not show up to that scene until the police department has gone there and made sure it is safe enough to have EMS arrive at. It's a little bit different with active shooters because there's this whole, you know, new field of like tactical medicine where folks are like cross-trained. But for most like, you know, reports of shootings and stabbings and things of the sort, there's this concept of nobody even approach. But it's different in the hospital. You know, we don't have this concept of nobody approach or enter the room until we secure it. So it's goes back to the whole culture component that makes it tricky.
I like that we're talking about this though, because just anecdotally in my own experience, actually studying this and talking about it has made me much more comfortable saying, nope, this is my limit. And even starting to think about where do I personally draw that line? And I think that's something we don't talk about enough because.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The fact that we're even discussing this is kind of crazy to me because as a medical student, you're sort of like when I was in training about 45 years ago, it was like you get the job done. It doesn't matter. Literally, we would be in like a code or someone would come in from in the emergency room and they'd be taking swings at you and you're supposed to be there like putting a line in. And I'm not saying that still might happen, but at least now we have to be discussing it and figuring out where the line is. I mean, that's a new concept, I think, for a lot of us. Here's another interesting question from Charlie LMSW with HEDS. Wow, it's a long title. At Charlie Shrimp, I'll just do at Charlie Shrimp at Twitter. It's an interesting topic I have not thought about, but home health safety issues and concerns. So I'm assuming that is actually even more of a concern because when we have nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors, people going to homes for home health checks, you're in their environment, much more likely that there's a gun lying around there than something they bring in. Is this something that's been discussed or you guys can speak on?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of literature that home health nurses and home health aides do have very high rates of workplace violence. And even though they don't meet that number one, two, or three, doesn't mean that the rates aren't very high. And I'll just add the little nuance there of, like, to Allison's point, why geriatrics was so high is there's a very high volume of, I would say, like, lower risk acts of violence, a lot of slapping and scratching. But, you know, just because that volume doesn't exist in home health, for example, doesn't mean that it's not very problematic. And you're right, you know, what do? You know, you're in like uncharted waters in terms of this person having, you know, access to whatever they want. It's like the power dynamic almost reverses in that environment. So it's very tricky.
Yeah. Well, you know, I am very impressed that you guys are addressing these things, that you guys know so much about it. I'm grateful that you are. I don't see a lot of other people doing it. I'm sure there are, but when I do a search through the medical literature, there wasn't a ton of information on this. I suspect you two are at the forefront of this, and hopefully you guys will continue to keep doing it and have fantastic careers, which I'm sure you both will, in psychiatry and then in emergency medicine for you, Yusuf. So thank you both. Let's get some plugs in here before we close up. I want people to know where to follow you if that's something you're into. Yusuf, what would you like to plug before we close up?
I'm on Twitter, OZ Yusuf, and eventually we'll be more active on there, but new to med Twitter.
Give them the spelling of your last name.
So that's Fawzi Yusuf, F-A-W-Z-Y, Yusuf, Y-O-U-S-O-F.
All right. We'll be watching your career with great interest, young man. And Allison, where can people find you, or what would you like to plug?
You can also find me on Twitter, like Yusuf, more recent user trying to get more adept with it, but you can follow me at A. Huckenpahler, H-U-C-K-E-N-P-A-H-L-E-R.
All right. No more people complaining about my name being difficult to spell, okay, or pronounce. All right. Ryan, my sweet Ryan, where can people find you? Let's talk about the YouTube channel. Let's talk about the YouTube channel. Where can people find that? What do people do if they want to look at you on YouTube? They just look into the YouTube box and say Ryan Marino MD. Is that it?
Yeah, it's Ryan MD. So it's easy to find. I'm still on Twitter. I don't know what's happening with social media. There's too many.
Are you on Blue Sky and Threads or whatever now?
Yeah.
I am too.
I like Blue Sky.
Blue Sky is a little bit less toxic. Yeah. Yeah. It seems a little bit more fun. It's a little bit more old school sort of Twitter vibe to it. But not a ton of people on it yet because of their whole like weird rate limiting thing. Threads I'm on, but I just don't think I can get into it. It's too much. I feel like I just don't have the time or the energy for this sort of stuff. Will one of them finally win? I want just one of them has to win this microblogging war. I'm kind of rooting for it to be Mastodon or Post, but I'm sure those guys are already out of the running. Follow Ryan. Definitely watch his YouTube channel. It's really interesting, and you get to look at his face while he talks, which is it's a huge plus. If you're not already following us, you can wherever. We're on all those places. Find us on Blue Sky, Threads. But more importantly, rate and review us at iTunes. That really helps get more listeners to the show. Thank you to Nadim for help with production. You guys have been fantastic. I'm super grateful for you guys spending so much time talking to us. Please keep in touch, everyone, okay?
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employers. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive!
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.